Good morning, and welcome to Family Day Yarche Kala. For those of you who are new to the Beit Midrash, the Yarche Kala programs are programs that we created, it's about 6 or 7 years ago, usually for statutory holidays, to invite the community to come into our home at Beit Midrash here in Yeshivat Or Chaim and to do some learning, which parallels the learning that we do in general. It's okay, you don't have to worry about taking pictures. Dan's taking pictures. We're good. Thanks. Thank you, though. The photographers can take pictures of each other. In the course of this year, we've been learning Kiddushin, issues that relate to marriage, and so our Yarche Kala programs as well have been marriage related. This one is as well. It's called the Tripartite Agreement, a prenup like no other. It involves some fascinating issues of halacha as well as psychology. I want to stress at the outset two things. Number one, that nothing I say should be taken in any way, shape, or form as halachic advice. I am discussing these halachic issues, but for halachic advice, please see a competent rabbi who knows you, knows your family, and can give proper counsel. That's number one. And number two, the prenuptial agreement we're going to be talking about today is, as is probably indicated from the title of the shiur, a controversial one. The original author is Rabbi Michael Broyd. He worked with, I believe, Tohenet Halacha Rachel Livmor. But Rabbi Broyd, aside from being a close family friend, is also a very serious Talmid Chacham. And when I voice the views that oppose this particular agreement, please don't take this in any way, shape, or form as a knock on him. I am not half the Talmid Chacham he is, not a quarter, and therefore certainly not someone who's able to disagree with him on that level. But that's okay, because I'm going to be quoting Rabbi Yonah Ries, who is opposed to it and who can certainly hold his own. The former head of the Beis Din of America of the RCA, now the head of the Beis Din in Chicago. So all I'm doing is just conveying ideas. Last, I will ask, please, that anyone with a cell phone should please mute it, vibrate it, or something. Okay. So, prenuptial agreements. I call this a prenup like no other. We're facing a fundamental problem when we deal with issues of marriage and divorce. And it's encapsulated in source number one. I hope you had a chance to see that during the preparation time, in which the Rambam tells us, Eina isha misgareshes ela biksav she'agia la. A woman can only be divorced by a written document which comes to her, uksav zehu hanikra get. This is what we call a get, and that's what we're going to be calling a get all through the next hour. And he says there are 10 elements you have to have for a get, and the very first one that he says is the man has to divorce her willingly. And this is learned from Sukkim. It's explicit in the Torah that the man is the one who chooses to give the get. Yes, I am aware that creates all sorts of problems. Yes, I am aware that that in the world of 2019 this seems awfully strange. Nonetheless, this is the restriction that we're working with, and everything that we're going to do to deal with situations in which the man refuses to give a get is based on that assumption that the Torah requires that the get be given at the man's will. I should note as well that midrabanan, a man cannot give a get to a woman unless she agrees to receive it, meaning that she also has to be a willing participant. The fact of the matter is, though, that in the majority of cases where a get is withheld, it's because the man is the one who's refusing to give it. I have seen cases in which a woman refuses to receive it, and those are stories for another time. But fundamentally, this triggers a terrible problem. What happens when a party to a marriage refuses to give a get or wants to use it as leverage for financial or custody purposes, and it creates terribly painful situations? And we need to figure out something, some way to avoid what this generates, which is what we call an aguna case, a case in which, in the cases that we're dealing with, the wife is chained to the marriage. marriage. She is unable to get out of the marriage because the husband is refusing to give the get. So on other occasions we've talked about what has become relatively standard, certainly within my rabbinical circles, and that is the prenuptial agreement that is approved by the Rabbinical Council of America. And it essentially has two parts, and almost every prenuptial agreement that you see anywhere is modeled in this way. Number one, it has an agreement of venue, meaning that the two sides, the man and the woman, agree before they ever get married that in the event of divorce discussions, they're going to resolve them in the following Beit Din. They say, this is the court that we're going to go to in order to take care of all of our issues. And that's really important because a lot of the battles that you see come about because one says, I want to go to this rabbinical court, and then they say, well, they know you, they'll favor you, they have a reputation, I want to go to that rabbinical court, and just the fight over venue can cause a lot of problems. Not only that, but the Rachel of Moore writes about a concern in Israel for a race. The idea being that each of them feels they need to be the one to file first because that will determine where the case is going to be handled within the Israeli courts. And the result is that a marriage which maybe needs work but isn't ready for a divorce will be hastened towards divorce because each one says, I don't want the other one to file first. So this will help you with that as you pick where you're going to go. Yeah?
Under Canadian law.
I'm going to come back to Canadian law.
No, back to the subject of jurisdiction of venue. Under Canadian law, you cannot choose the jurisdiction as where you were when you split up. So how does it factor in under rabbinical law?
Right. Right. So I'm going to come back to Canadian law because we'll see. The Canadian law is a different animal altogether, but in terms of halacha, there is indeed the possibility of going to a particular Beit Din locally to resolve the dispute. We live in a world in which you can have multiple Beit Din, multiple courts within the same location. Wasn't always the case, but it is the case now, and therefore you could have this kind of competing, this kind of competition. The Canadian case is a whole different breed, it's a whole different thing for reasons that we'll get to, but that's your first part. Your second part is a stipulated per day support payment that the man agrees to provide for his wife in the event that he moves out and refuses to respond to her request for a get. That amount in the standard RCA version is $150 per day indexed to the U.S. Consumer Price Index. And basically it's just a support payment, maybe on steroids, but depending on who you ask about, you know, how much money they need to live. But that agreement actually, thank God, has a very, very, very good track record for helping the husband recognize that it's in his best interest to give the get. And I actually communicated with Shlomo Weissman, who of course is married into the Toronto family and therefore has great yichus. His father-in-law is here. But I spoke to him about it because there was a claim going back about 10-15 years that there has never been a case of a couple that used the RCA prenup and had an aguna problem. So I asked him, can you give me updated statistics? So he didn't want to do that. It's sort of, you can say ayin hara or jinx, depending on how you feel. But once you say this has never happened, you're just daring somebody to cause a problem. But the truth is, it has a really, really good track record. That's the standard. That's the standard model. And what you're really doing in that model is you're saying the following. If the day comes when he doesn't agree to give a get, we are going to smooth the way towards a get. Number one, by removing the fight about which court is amenable to his claims or her claims. And number two, by giving him a financial incentive to help convince him to proceed with the get. But fundamentally, it's a normal divorce. It's a normal get given, under the auspices of a Beit Din, and it's just made easier. This tripartite agreement is something else entirely. Now, the question came up this morning, what does tripartite actually mean? So I thank Rabbi Yaris for emailing me the definition online. Tripartite can mean there are three parties involved. That's not the case here. Rather, tripartite means the second definition, which is an agreement with three parts. That's what it is. And what it does is it stitches together three means by which to create a divorce. Number one, a conditional marriage. Meaning, the entire marriage is entered into on condition that if they live apart for 15 months and the wife requests a get and he does not comply, the marriage is invalid from the start. This is not a new idea. Rabbi Ries, in a shiur on this topic, notes that the idea came up at the start of the 20th century from a group of rabbis in France, and they wanted to already put this together because they were dealing with aguna problems, and all the major European halachic authorities of the time, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Mozer, all the big names came together to say, we're sorry, but this mechanism doesn't work for reasons that we're going to have to talk about. It came up again in the middle of the 20th century, this time in Constantinople, and Rav Ben Sion Uziel was involved. It's come up over the years, but that's one piece of the three, an attempt to say the marriage is conditional. Second, a pre-arranged get. Before the marriage begins, the man licenses an agent, or any agent, anyone who sees the document that he has written, saying, I want you to write a get in the event that my wife requests a get. He has pre-authorized the writing of a get for his wife. And then number three, and that is nullification of the marriage. In the event that they live apart for 15 months, his wife requests a get, he has not complied, they say, we are part of a community, and this is a fictitious community, whose rabbis have decreed that in the event that the members of our community are apart for 15 months and the get is requested and not given, the marriage is void from the beginning. The rabbis simply cancel the marriage. They nullify the marriage. And that's the third method of this. They stitch these three methods together, and as we'll see, there are certain interactions between the methods that make each other stronger. None of these methods is great. And Rabbi Broid acknowledges that. He says, none of these methods independently would work. But if you take all of them together, and you take the individual rabbis who support each of the three methods together, you can build a case that collectively that becomes a strong enough view that a get given on this basis will be valid. What are the benefits of this method? Well, first of all, no cooperation from the husband is needed anymore. Right? The prenup, the standard prenup I described, relies on there being incentives to get the husband to cooperate. Now, there's no need for the husband to cooperate at all. These mechanisms are all locked in from the beginning. You're living apart for 15 months. You didn't give the get. Someone's going to give a get on your behalf, so don't worry. That's number one. The get's going to get given anyway. Number two, your marriage was conditional, and it will be voided because the condition was not fulfilled. And number three, the rabbis are already removing it. And there's even a four and five, as we'll see, along the way. But those are the three essential parts. And to go back to Steve's point, which wasn't your direct point, but you raised it, this will work in Canada. A standard RCA prenup has no teeth in Canada. And the reason for it is fairly straightforward. Going back to when there was legislation made that was meant to avoid having religious courts, in particular Sharia courts, be involved in family law matters, the law was altered to say that religious courts are not able to handle family law cases. Which means that the RCA prenup can't do anything. Because sending them to a Beit Din and saying the Beit Din is going to handle your divorce issues, they don't have the ability to handle it. They can handle religious divorce, but there's nothing to make anybody go there. They aren't going to be able to do it. So the RCA prenup has no teeth. Canada does have a get law, and that's a shear for another time. It happens to be very good in my humble opinion, but it will also not work in 100% of cases. In this case, the marriage is simply gone. The religious marriage is simply gone. It will work in any jurisdiction. So that's a major advantage of it. Now, when Rabbi Broid put it forth originally, he said, I'm not saying anybody should do this. I'm saying that here's an idea, and if rabbis will sign on, then I think we have a plan that could actually be done en masse, and it will solve our problems. He then wrote an article in the journal Truman a couple of years ago, or maybe last year, saying that he knows of tens of couples who have already used it. There are people I know who are using it. So what I want to do is look at how this works and what the challenges are from a technical level and what the challenges are, as we'll see, on a psychological level. Steve.
You said something about this document, Voice the Marriage, Ab Initio.
Yes.
To get a guest, you need to have a valid marriage.
Correct.
If this contract effectively renders the marriage void ab initio,
yes.
You don't need a guest.
Correct. You'll see.
All really you need is a contract with a base deed to give them the power to nullify a marriage.
Right, so it's not that simple. The basic reason why it's not that simple is because voiding a marriage is extremely problematic, and it's only one of the mechanisms he uses because it's problematic. In other words, what he's saying is, this method works according to some, this method works according to some, this method works according to some, and if we put together all the sums, the sum of the sums, so to speak, will be sufficient that it'll be effective. That's the argument that he's making. But yes, in the event that voiding the marriage worked, there would be no requirement for a get, but again, it's not that simple. We're going to see some of it, God willing, as we go through this. To be clear, everyone is looking for a solution for this problem. You can't have a heart without being concerned and without knowing that there are people living in pain on a day-by-day basis. And you have to do something for it. This is about one particular attempt, and the debate between those who accept it and those who don't accept it is a debate of not about the goals, but about how you get there. So, let's talk about the halachic logic that is the underpinning of the agreement, and I hope that during the prep time, people had a chance to go through the sources that I brought, but take a look on your sheet. Source number 2. That's the tripartite agreement itself, the bulk of it, not all of it. I brought the parts that were relevant for the halachic discussion. So, the paragraph that I marked 1 is a positive clause, in which the man says that he is giving his wife kiddushin. Remember that Jewish marriage has 2 stages to it. There is the kiddushin stage, in which, for the purpose of our discussion, the man gives the woman something of value, usually a ring, doesn't have to be. But that's your kiddushin stage. And then the nisuin stage, sheva bracha, 7 blessings recited under the chuppah. And again, there's more to both stages, but that's all that matters for our discussion right now. The man offers kiddushin here, according to the laws of Moses and the people of Israel, subject to the following conditions. Condition 1, he says, if I return to live in our marital home with you present at least once every 15 months until either you or I die, then our kiddushin and our nisuin shall remain valid and binding. That's the positive phrase. Then the negative is the start of number 2. But if I am absent from our joint marital home for 15 months continuously, for whatever reason, even by duress, then our kiddushin and nisuin will have been null and void. Our conduct should be like unmarried people sharing a residence. The blessings recited a nullity. The ring I gave you should be a gift. It's all nothing. It's worded in the positive in number 1 and the negative in number 2 as part of a principle we're not going into at length here, but it's called Tanai B'nei Gad U'B'nei Re'uven. The principle is, as brought in the Shulchan Aruch and Ebene Ezra Lamed Ches, that when you want conditions to be valid in a contract, you have to state the positive and the negative. If I do this, then X. If I do not do this, then Y. So he words the positive. If I am home at any point within the 15-month period, the clock starts again. If I'm not home for 15 months, my wife wants to get, dot, 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 then this is what's going to happen. Max.
Is there a reason that the 15 months?
Right, so I don't know why they came up with 15 months as the number.
Isn't 15 months already far exceeding? Like,
the answer is I don't know.
He's already been depriving her own ass.
So it would appear. Sheldon.
Return to live means what?
Return to live means that he is there with that as his residence. Apparently a day will count. That's what it sounds like. So that's your conditional marriage. Now, he continues to say, I recite this condition to our marriage not only during the wedding ceremony, but prior to our intimate relationship and yichud. I take a public oath that I will never remove this condition from the marriage. And he says, I am doing this by means of a kinyan, a formal transaction, before I based in chashuv, an esteemed rabbinical court. The purpose of that statement about kinyan chashuv and rabbinical and doing it in front of an esteemed rabbinical court is because of the following. We have a concern called asmachta. Asmachta is a term that we use for our purposes for an agreement that somebody enters into that they never ever intend to have to play out. So for example, you hire somebody to shovel your walk, right? And he says, I'm going to show up within an hour of when the snow stops. Every single time it snows more than 5 centimeters, whatever it is, I will be there within an hour. And in the event that I'm not there within an hour, I owe you $1 million. Everybody knows that when someone makes an agreement like that, he doesn't intend to ever pay you $1 million. He just thinks it's within his capacity to make sure that I'll be there within an hour. That's called an asmachta. It's something he never ever dreamed he would have to go carry through. And in halacha, an asmachta is not binding. When everybody knows that you weren't serious, you're not serious, and it's not binding. However, somebody can make a deal that looks like an asmachta and yet have it be binding if he does it in a serious way. Such as saying, I am engaging in a transaction formally in front of an esteemed rabbinical court. That's what he's doing in this document with this clause. The above condition is made in accordance with the laws of Betorah, dot, dot, dot. You can see source number 2. But I want to highlight for you what the basis is for the idea that you could use conditional marriage at all. If you jump on the source sheet to source number 3, by Moshe Isserles, also known as Rama, deals with the following scenario. A man and a woman are going to get married. The man has a brother. His brother is a mumar. His brother does not believe in anything Jewish. Not only does he not believe in anything Jewish, but for the purpose of our discussion, he is antagonistic to Judaism. He wants nothing to do with it whatsoever. He will never participate in a religious ceremony whatsoever. And the woman is worried. What happens, God forbid, her husband dies and they don't have any children? Now, she needs either Yibum, where she marries her brother-in-law, or Chalitza, the ritual in which they separate. But she knows her brother-in-law is never ever going to agree to any of that. So what can she do? Rabbi Isserles writes, here we could use conditional marriage. Take a look at number 3, please. I'm going to work with my English translations in the interest of time, but you have the original Hebrew there to see as well. And one who performs kiddushin for a woman and has a brother who is an apostate may perform kiddushin with a dual structure condition, meaning you state the positive, if this, then whatever, if not this, then whatever. A dual structure condition that if she should require yibum before the apostate, the kiddushin is invalid. It's a condition saying, I am only going to be married in the event that I don't need yibum, and in the event that I end up needing yibum, the whole marriage was void from the beginning. It's a conditional marriage. The Rama, I think, a fairly strong halachic authority, is endorsing it. Not only that, if you take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, a great halachic authority from the beginning of the 20th century, Rav of the community in Novardok, writes that it isn't only applied to the case of the brother who is a mumar, but also if one has a brother who is a chereish. A chereish, for our purposes, I'm not going into all of the ins and outs, is somebody who is ineligible to perform chalitza. He cannot separate, he cannot perform the rite that would break the bond between him and his sister-in-law. Or, where the brother is missing. Nobody has any idea where the brother is. In all those cases, they're willing to accept the idea of conditional marriage. So Rabbi Broid looks at that and says, that's my stage 1. Conditional marriage. That's number 1. Go back now, please, to the agreement itself. And the second part of it, it's part 3 in my Roman numerals, pre-planning a get. Should a Jewish divorce be requested of me for whatever reason by any Orthodox rabbinical court selected by my wife, even if at the time of our separation I explicitly reject the particular rabbinical court she selects, I also appoint anyone who will see my signature on this form or a copy of this form to act as a scribe to acquire pen, ink, and feather for me and write a get, one or more to divorce with it, my wife, and I skipped a lot of verbiage at this stage. It's just more of the same, how he authorizes anybody who authorizes 100 people, it doesn't matter however many people want to write a get, all of them are authorized to write a get on his behalf. And then he continues, I undertake with all seriousness, even with an oath of the Torah, that I will not nullify the effectiveness of the get to divorce my wife, or the power of the above mentioned messenger to deliver it to my wife, and I nullify any kind of statement I may have made which could hurt the effectiveness of the get to divorce my wife, or the effectiveness of the messenger to deliver it to my wife, even if my wife and I should continue to reside together, ... flipping the page, I have authorized the writing, signing, and delivery of a get. Doesn't make a difference. Whatever I do, this authorization continues. And my wife shall be believed like 100 witnesses to testify I have not nullified my authorization to appoint the scribe to write the get on my behalf. So he's authorizing a get. Now, what's your precedent for this kind of authorization? The case that Rav Herzog dealt with in source number 5. Rav Yitzchak Halevi Herzog was the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the new state of Israel when it was formed, and he dealt with a problem which the Gemara talks about going back to the days of Shaul and David, which was the Jewish soldier who goes off to war and disappears, and now his wife is stuck. And he said, I'd like to have an agreement in which a get is written for these men, and that way their wives have a get, and therefore they are divorced if the husband doesn't return after some period of time. But he says, that's really hard to do on a practical level. Writing a get is not simple and straightforward. You're going to write a get for all these soldiers when they're going off to war. That's really hard. Not to mention the problem that the guy comes home on leave, and then he is with his wife again. So he says, let's come up with another system called an authorization. And that's source number 5, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, and continues on to the next. I'm going to read out from my translation. He said, arranging a get for each soldier who goes to war is difficult when they separate, when the husband and wife part, and impossible on a practical level, other than by arranging to license an agent. In this, too, there is great room for debate. Only here we stumble into a difficulty when the husband arrives on furlough. If the get has not yet been executed, there is concern for canceling it when he returns. He comes home, he doesn't want to be divorced, he wants to be married. So he says, let us address this concern. Rambam rules that if one tells witnesses to write thus, meaning to write a get, and he is then alone with his wife, and then the witnesses write the get and deliver it to her, it is void. Ramban and others have disputed this, saying she might be divorced, it might be a valid get. But opposite this concern, he says, in terms of the worry that when he is alone with his wife, he cancels the license to write a get, we have already established that since he swears a serious oath, accepting upon penalty of cherem, that he will not cancel the agency, we may presume he has not canceled it, so long as we do not hear him do so explicitly. So in other words, as part of what Rabbi Herzog has them do, they don't just authorize an agent to write and deliver the get, but they actually say, and I am never, ever, ever going to cancel this license to the person to give the get. And he says, everybody agrees to this. Further, Rabbi Herzog says, why would he cancel it? He's doing this in order to help his wife. The point is out of love for her. He wants to take care of her in the event that he disappears. He doesn't want her to be stuck. So there's no reason to think that just because he came home, he's going to cancel the license for the get. That's Rabbi Herzog's argument. You can see the rest of it spelled out here on the sheet. So that's your second of three parts. Morris.
It's a good job. Herzog states, like in the middle there, that if the husband does exclusively revoke this shvua, then that's revocation. So
correct.
In terms of the tripartite agreement,
right. So you are ahead of me, but you are correct in being ahead of me. Meaning you picked up on the words within Rabbi Herzog that are going to be problematic. If we hear the guy revoke it, and a guy jumping up and down and saying, I don't care that there are people demonstrating outside my house, I refuse to give a get, would seem to be revoking it, then indeed we're going to have a problem. But this is the idea that they're basing it on, is the statement of Rabbi Herzog, the idea that he put forth, which was also supported by some others at the time. That's your second piece. And then your third piece. And the third piece is this communal enactment to nullify the marriage. Going back again to the text of the agreement, the part that's labeled Roman numeral 4. Furthermore, I recognize that my wife has agreed to marry me only with the understanding that should she wish to be divorced, I would give a get within 15 months of her requesting such a bill of divorce. I recognize, should I decline to give such a get for whatever reason, even based on my duress, I have violated the agreement that is the predicate for our marriage, and I consent for our marriage to be labeled a nullity based on the decree of our community that all marriages ought to end with a get given within 15 months. We both belong to a community where the majority of the great rabbis and the Batei Din of that community have authorized the use of annulment in cases like this, and I accept the communal decree on this matter as binding upon me. There is no such community. This is an invention. However, we do have inventions like this in Halakha. Right? We do things like this. To make a statement that I owe, if I were to make a declaration that I owe somebody $1 million, and I said that in front of witnesses, with a kinyan and the whole bit, I would owe them $1 million. Even if I said I owe it to them because they lent it to me and there never was any such loan. Doesn't matter. You create an artificial debt. So what you're doing here is creating an artificial communal enactment that both of them are acknowledging as binding upon them. That's the idea. Gerald.
By nullifying a marriage of that situation, any nullification situations, is that a ramification of the children form, or are they now not able to marry for honeymoon or anything like that?
So it does potentially have ramifications for the children. Absolutely. It means that the relations that they had all along were what we call zinut.
What if one of those marriages are quite
So, no. I do not believe it would result in a requirement to divorce. No. The idea of nullifying a marriage is based on what you see in source number 6. Source number 6, a classic Gemara in Gittin, dealing with a very particular problem. One way in which a couple can get divorced is if the husband authorizes the writing of a get and hands it to a shaliach, hands it to an agent, and says to the agent, I want you to deliver this to my wife. However, the sages were concerned about the following case. The man gives it to his shaliach, waits for the shaliach to get out of sight, and then cancels the get. Says, forget it. This get is null and void. The shaliach, of course, gets to his destination, delivers the get, not knowing. The wife thinks that she is divorced, and all along, he has actually canceled the get. So take a look at source number 6. Brisa says, first of all, you're not allowed to do that. That's first of all. But our sages taught, if he canceled the agent illegally, because you're not allowed to do it, the agent is still canceled, according to Rebbe. Meaning the get is invalid, but he wasn't supposed to do it, but the get in fact is invalid. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, no, he cannot cancel the agent, and he cannot alter his stated condition with which he licensed the get. If he could, what would the court's enactment be worth? He said, all these rules that we have, what's called tikkun olam, the enactments that are made to prevent somebody from doing this to his wife, are all going to be meaningless if in fact he's able to succeed in canceling the get. To which the Gemara says, well, it's all well and good that you're concerned for her, but you're telling me that biblically the get is valid, and rabbinically, the get is invalid? I'm sorry, the other way around. Biblically, the get is invalid. And rabbinically, the get is going to be valid? That means that biblically, she's a married woman. But the rabbis are saying, no, you can go ahead and get married. That's hard for the Gemara to wrap its mind around. So the Gemara says, no, that's not what happens. Rather, what we do is, we remove his kiddushin. We remove the kiddushin. Afkeinu rabbanon the kiddushin dinei. We disqualify the whole marriage from the get-go. Ab initio. So the Gemara is then bothered. How did that happen? What do you mean? You just snapped your fingers and the marriage is gone? So they say, no. When a man marries a woman, assuming that he did it with kesef, he gives her something of value. Well, the rabbis have authority, which goes back to biblical law, called hefker beis din. The rabbis are allowed to declare, you think you own that, you don't actually own it. What the precedent for it is a nice discussion for another time. They have the ability to cancel your ownership of property. So what they do is, they time travel. And they say, you thought you owned that ring that you gave her. Ha, you never owned that ring that you gave her. That ring wasn't yours. Therefore, you're not married. To which the Gemara says, but wait, that's fine in terms of the ring. But he's been living with her. What do you do with that? You can't declare that hefker. And the answer is, yeah, actually we can. We can declare that hefker. That's exactly what we do. The rabbis declared these relations to be acts of zinut. They are immoral relations, and the marriage is indeed void. Now, hang on. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Rabbi Zion Uziel, who dealt with these issues for the rabbis in Constantinople, says that the idea of removing kiddushin, say you're no longer married, is of a very narrow context. It doesn't license them to whatever they wish. Simply say, we think those two people shouldn't be married. We've just, you know, voided their marriage. He says it only applies if you look at the paradigm in three types of cases. Number one, if the kiddushin itself was done in some improper way, then they are able to say, forget it, the kiddushin never happened. Number two, if there's testimony that the husband is dead, but we don't have sufficient testimony to rely on it such that she could be declared a widow and free to marry, that's your second case. And then your third case would be the case of a get which is disputed. If there's a get and the validity of the get is disputed, then you're able to come in and say, we remove the kiddushin. And that's the case of the Gemara in Gittin in source number 6. There's a get, there's a question about its validity, and therefore they're able to nullify it. Max?
Are there limitations on the application of hefker based in hefker then?
There are, although it's broader than this discussion.
If you just say it's hefker based in hefker, then why are you limited to just these three cases?
Because the marriage isn't only about the money he gave her in the beginning. They've been living together as husband and wife for years.
But does it only work by kiddushin the kesef?
So that's the hefker beis din. Yeah, hefker beis din is a money thing.
No, but like, that beis din afkeinu.
Afkeinu goes beyond it. It's turning his bia into bia's nus. It is beyond it. That's why we're saying it's only limited to these particular cases. John.
The cancellation of the kiddushin, how does that affect any children who were married?
So those children are considered to have been children born out of wedlock. They're not mamzerim. Let me be very clear about that. That doesn't convey mamzer status.
They have right of claim on their father.
Inheritance still exists. Support obligations still exist. Yeah, it doesn't get rid of any of those. Sorry? So we didn't get to Mekach Tod yet. We're getting to it very shortly. We're not quite there yet. But this is the idea, and there's precedent for making such a condition proactively. The Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, in source number 8, dealt with a case in which a man gave a woman a sitter outside of shul. And he said, Hare at. And she accepted the sitter. But then she said, I didn't intend to actually be married to him. And the Rashba, in discussing the disposition of the case, says, I think it would be a really good idea if our communities would make a proactive rule. If the communities, or every community, I'm not sure of what his distinction there is between the communities and every community. Nonetheless, If they wish to erect a fence to prevent these problems, they can make an enactment in full assembly and remove thenceforth or until such time as they choose any money given to any woman of the community with a full removal as hefker unless she accepts it willingly and with her father's will. Of course, this is, after all, 13th century Spain. Or before so-and-so and so-and-so, the following people have to be present as they choose. And so I found Rav Shri Ragon enacted, 10th century, him and his fathers, and telling another community to do this. They told other communities to do it as well. So the argument is, that's my third part. First part, the marriage is conditional on him divorcing her in the event that they were apart for 15 months. Number two, the second of the three parts, he licenses someone to give a get when she asks for it. And number three, the statement of, in the event that I don't give a get and we're apart for 15 months, the marriage is null from the start. The rest of the agreement, which I'm just going to summarize in the interests of time, but you can see it in number five, is the statement that if any of this is deemed ineffective, we won't have married at all. This goes back to what Morris asked about. We call mekaktos, the idea that I'm only getting married because I think this works. And if it turns out this doesn't work, then the whole marriage was based on a mistake. And therefore, I am not married. That's the mekaktos argument. That's one. And then the last part, part six, the wife confirms the terms of the agreement because her conditions are of great significance as well. I brought you on the sheet in source number 9 and number 10 that she is able to make conditions as well. She can also nullify conditions, which is going to be important as well. We're not quite ready for source number 10 yet, but you'll see when we get to a little bit further along why number 10 matters. But she is making these conditions as well for her. So that's the tripartite agreement. It took us 40 minutes to get this far. But once we know what the agreement is, it becomes a lot easier to talk about what the challenges are. So, first part, technical challenges. If you flip to the end of your source sheet, the back panel, I gave you a table there for this. So in the first column of the table, you have the three different parts of the agreement. The second column of the table, you have supporting examples, avoiding Yibum, right, with an apostate for the conditional marriage, with Herzog's idea for the IDF, for the prearranged get, and communal nullification as seen in the Rashba's suggestion for communities. Now we're into what I called in here practical challenges. That's the wrong word. I should have said legal challenges. I don't know why I wrote the word practical. It was probably because it was 11 o'clock last night. But I meant legal challenges. These are technical problems. So the problem with the conditional marriage piece of it is, first of all, that the case of Yibum may not be a solid precedent because there are elements of it that don't apply here. Specifically, in the case of the Yibum Mumar concern, what's the worst case scenario? Let's pretend conditional marriage doesn't work. You're making this whole thing, this whole assumption about conditional marriage. Let's say conditional marriage does not work. Now what has happened? Sorry? Is she stuck? No. She thinks conditional marriage works. Let's say we're wrong, but we don't know. Okay? So she got married to a guy. The guy died without children, Rahman al-Islam, and now she is up for Yibum. She thinks she's not up for Yibum because they had a condition. Right? No. No mekaktos issue. So she's a widow who went and got married to somebody. Right? Thinking that her first marriage was void. Yes, she was supposed to have Yibum or Chalitza. And halachically, if she asked her rabbi, can I get married without Yibum or Chalitza, the rabbi would say no. Because you have to first take care of Yibum or Chalitza. But in the event that she does get married, it's not a case of adultery. She's not married to the brother-in-law. In the event that we're wrong and conditional marriage doesn't work, you haven't licensed a married woman to take another husband. As opposed to, in the prenup, if we're wrong about conditional marriage, and again, wrong about all the different parts and so on, then you've actually taken a woman who was a married woman and told her, go get married to somebody else. You've told her she's divorced when she's not. And so that's a major objection to this, is simply you're drawing an analogy to a case in which the price for being wrong is much lower than in our case. Kobe, you were going to ask a question?
No. Okay.
That's technical objection number one. Technical objection number two is, how do you know that he kept this in mind, his condition, all through the marriage? This idea that he has this condition, maybe at some point when he lived with her, maybe even at the time of marriage itself, he didn't keep this in mind. That's why Rav Uziel, in his piece on this, in source number 12, requires that you do more than just state the condition initially. He wants you to do more than that. It emerges that if he states a condition at the time of marriage or relations, the condition is binding. And if it is not fulfilled, then the marriage is retroactively canceled. You need to keep on stating the condition throughout. That's why we had that wording in the document, saying that he restates it under the chuppah, and it's as though he is restating it at the time of relations. They don't actually require restating it at the time of relations, because that's a little bit awkward. Because there are witnesses. You don't want to play that game. But that's really what should be required, and that's a concern. That's a technical concern. The second part of this, the pre-arranged get. The argument once again is that the case of the IDF is not necessarily a valid precedent for a couple of reasons. First of all, because not everybody supported Rav Herzog's idea that you could say, I am licensing someone to write the get and then go home on leave and be with your wife and it won't cancel the authorization of the get. But not just that. In the case of the IDF, you're talking about where somebody has disappeared and they can't find him. And therefore, unfortunately, in the majority of cases, the husband actually is dead. You come back again to being like the Mumar situation, the Yibum situation, where the husband is probably gone altogether. So that's one objection to the prearranged get. The other objection to the prearranged get, frankly, is much stronger. And that is this. We have a principle in halakha. I can't appoint somebody to be my agent to do something that I am ineligible to do. That's a basic rule. I can't appoint someone to do something that I am not qualified to do. When is this guy assigning somebody to write a get on his behalf? No. When is he making the assignment? Before he's married. You can't divorce your wife before you've married her. That's just the way it works. So therefore you can't authorize somebody to do it before marriage. And I've never seen a good rebuttal to this point. It seems like a fairly cut and dry technical point. But that really poses what seems to be a problem. And if you're going to tell me, let's just do it after we're married, there are a lot easier ways to do this after one's married. There are such things. Postnuptial agreements exist, and they're a lot easier halachically than any of this. But the third part of the agreement, the takana of the community to nullify the marriage. Take a look at source number 13. Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes, if a community enacts an agreement among themselves that anyone who performs kiddushin without 10 present, that would be an example of saying you need a minion present for kiddushin to be valid. And if not, they're not performing a valid kiddushin. And one of them trespasses and performs such a kiddushin, we are concerned for kiddushin and a get is required, even though you made a rule saying that without a minion, we disqualify your kiddushin, we still want to get. Why? Because we're not really confident in the rabbi's ability to nullify marriage. And therefore we want there to be a get. So therefore the argument goes, you can't rely on hafka'ah alone, on voiding the marriage alone. To which Rabbi Broid responds, that's the beauty of this thing, because your three parts interact. You have a get because of harshah, because you licensed someone to write it. To which Rabbi Reis says, yeah, but we didn't accept that get. That get isn't anything. That get is meaningless because we already said we don't agree that this authorization is actually binding. But that's one set of objections on a technical level is voiding the marriage doesn't work if you don't have an existing get. And then objection number two is that we've never ever had such an enactment that says if they're apart for 15 months, then the marriage is void. You're pretending that there is such a such an enactment. Those are the technical objections. Again, as stated on the table, so you can see it in order. Objection to the conditional marriage is the Yibum model isn't really appropriate because there she's single anyway, and he might forget the condition at the time of the marriage or later and intend to be married to her. Objection to the prearranged get is that the IVF case is different, and you can't make an agent before the wedding to divorce your wife. And the communal nullification, the objection there is that even if you nullify, there has to be a get. And we've never had such communal enactments at all. You can't say you're part of a community that has such an enactment. But the more interesting part for me is the psychological set of issues here. The intersection of law and psychology. Because there are certain psychological givens which underlie halacha. You have to keep in mind, in general, all systems of law need to operate with certain psychological givens. And especially when you get into the realm of contract law. Right? Think about it from a secular perspective. Forget it within the realm of halacha. You hire somebody to do a job. What time does he have to be there? What time is he allowed to leave? How long are his breaks? You don't write everything down in an agreement. There are certain things that are simply givens. You know that certain things are allowed and certain things are not allowed. Is he allowed to use his coffee mug if he stays late and it's the business's coffee mug and can he use their coffee while he's working there? Can he take the coffee mug home? There are certain things that are just understood to be part of what everybody is thinking when they enter into a business deal. You sell someone to something. What's included in the sale? You sell a house. What's included in the house sale? What's not included in the sale of the house? You enter into an agreement. There's consideration. What constitutes valid consideration for the agreement? What types of language or behavior demonstrate that you're serious about something? Does a verbal agreement, as the phrase goes, is a verbal agreement worth the paper it's written on? All of these things are based on, all these rules are based on, psychological assumptions. What are people thinking? And the same thing is true within halacha. And an important set of arguments between the supporters of the tripartite agreement and its detractors are about the question of the assumptions halacha makes about the party's intent when they enter into an agreement. Very important, because if a legal agreement contradicts the intentions of the parties, you know what we call it? A legal fiction. Right? If you enter into a legal agreement that is meant to serve your ends, even though it's not at all what you want, it's what we call a legal fiction. And that is the argument. That's what's going on here. He wants to be married to her. That's his goal. His goal is not to license somebody to divorce her. His goal is not to void his marriage. And therefore the argument goes, this is a legal fiction. And then we unpack that, because the objections really are in terms of the first two parts of the tripartite agreement. First of all, the conditional marriage. Let's go back to the case of the mumar that you want to use as precedent. Rabbi Reis, in an article on this, notes two reasons why the case of the mumar is not a good precedent, aside from the points we've already made before. We have a principle in the Gemara, which, actually, I'll show it to you now. It's going to come up later, but I'll show it to you already. There's no reason not to. If you take a look at, which one do I want? Now I see why I did it this way on the sheet. All right. I'm going to state it outside of the text, and then we'll see how it's relevant. The rule is, Ein Adam Osa Be'ilaso Be'ilas Zinus. What it means is, one does not enter into relations intending for them to be considered promiscuous, intending for them to be considered immoral. Now, there are different ways to explain that assumption, and we're going to see two different ways to view that, but that's a basic principle. Ein adam osa be'ilaso be'ilas zinus. People do not intend for their relationships to be zinut, and certainly not if they have the option of doing it in a kosher way. That's a very important principle within this discussion, because Rabbi Reis argues, in the case of the Mumar, right? The man and the woman are married. They don't have any children. The husband dies. The wife is now up for Yibum, and therefore you say, no, the whole marriage is void. A couple of people have already asked, doesn't that mean that every time they were together, all through the marriage, that's now considered relations out of wedlock? Right? That's the argument. Doesn't that make that relations out of wedlock? And the answer is, he might not care. First of all, because he's gone. He's off in Olam Haba at this point. You can tell me that his relations were zinut. It's not going to affect him in Olam Haba anymore, because they know that he thought he was in a real marriage at the time, so they don't care. He doesn't care about what people are going to say about him, because he's not here anymore. In the Yibum case, the argument can be made, he doesn't care that you're going to turn his marriage into a non-marriage. That's number one. And number two, going back to the question that was asked about his kids, there is no concern of labeling his kids out of wedlock children, because there are no children. However, if you're going to apply this in the case of the prenup, number one, he's still alive, and number two, there can be kids. Are you sure that he is going to be willing to follow this condition and have his marriage declared a non-marriage and have his children declared children born out of wedlock? Kobe.
Okay. Children born out of wedlock are not voluntary.
Correct.
So then what are we, what are we kidding? Like, what is there, what
right. So what creates is something called pigam, and there may be issues in terms of marrying a Kohen.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe because it's not so clear cut. That's why I mean maybe. Maybe because it's maybe.
So if you're married,
I'm not going through it right now.
If you happen to be married to a Kohen,
you have to end the marriage? No, not, it would not be enough to require ending a marriage, but it would be enough to potentially disqualify entry into a marriage. Correct. So again, I'm really not going there with this in the show. After the recorder is off, we can have a conversation. But because I'm not saying that to be coy. I'm saying it because I didn't do the research in advance of it, and I don't want to give a wrong answer on a recording. I can give a wrong answer, but it's not being recorded. I'd rather have the conversation that way. But that's one set of psychological issues here. When you're dealing with the paradigm of Yibum, there's a lot more reason to say that he's comfortable with the idea his marriage will be declared void. But in our case, it's a lot less likely. That's number one. Number two, we have a basic rule in the Gemara called Ein Tnai B'Nisuin. There is no such thing as marriage that is on condition. It's a Gemara in Yevamos Daf Kuf Zayin, and Rashi there explains why. It's the rule that I just stated. Ein Adam Oseh B'Ilaso B'Ila Zinus. He doesn't want his relations to turn out to be immoral relations. I brought you sources on the sheet supporting this, but I see that we're at 56 minutes in, so I'm going to sum up what you see on the sheet. Source number 14 is a Mishnah in Gittin. Talks about the following case. A man and a woman get divorced. Then they're traveling and they end up staying in the same hotel. The concern is that something happens between them. Beit Hillel says there's a need for a new get. Why is there a need for a new get? Number one, we're worried that something in fact happened between the two of them. And number two, his intent was for marriage when that happened between the two of them. Why? Because he doesn't want his relations to be immoral. He intends the relations to be for the sake of marriage, and the assumption is for her as well. And this is what I brought you in source number 10. She also, it's not just him, I'm wording it in the male, but it's true for the female as well, she does not want her relations to be zinut. So, in other words, if they live together, the assumption is they live together intending for it to be valid as kiddushin. That's the concern. Now, you might challenge us and say, is that still true? Maybe that was true 2,000 years ago. But today, do people really care that much? To which I would give you two answers. Answer number one is the couple in front of us coming for this prenuptial agreement is a couple that wants to do things halachically. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here having this conversation. So, number one, this is a couple that cares about biyad zinut. But number two, the idea that one does not wish one's relationship to be zinut could be taken in two different ways. One way to take it is the way that I've explained it until now, which is the way that many writers take it, which is that a person doesn't want their relations to be declared prohibited. They don't want to be declared outlaws. But there's another way that this is taken, it appears, by the Rambam, and explained that way by the Or Sameach. I brought you them in source number 15 and number 16, but I'm going to explain it outside. And that is, the Rambam writes there that the rule that says one does not want his relations to be declared znut, he says that only applies to a man who had been married to this woman before. However, if there's a random single guy and single girl, and they are together one night, we don't apply this rule at all. That's what the Rambam says. We say that is znut. That certainly is an out-of-wedlock relationship. And it's understood that we don't assume that they intended it to be for marriage. Why? So as the Or Sameach explains, although I think the Rambam is actually fairly clear in this regard, the idea that one does not make his relations into znut means not a halachic concern, but a psychological concern. If you are with somebody, you want it to mean something. That's the idea. One does not want the relationship to be nothing. If they demonstrate that it's nothing, single guy, single girl, and they meet for one day and then they leave, then okay, they demonstrated that it's meaningless to them. But if you're talking about a man and a woman who are married, they have a house together, they file taxes jointly, they do everything that indicates that they're married. The assumption is that their intent is for marriage. That's the meaning of Ein Adam Osa Bilaso Bilas Zinus, as explained by the Or Sameach, and I think fairly clear in that Rambam. And therefore the argument goes, you're talking about a conditional marriage. First of all, your Yibum case is not valid as a basis. That's number one, for the reasons that we outlined. But number two, when he lives with her, he cancels the condition. He wants to live with her as her husband, and he does not want someone at some point to disqualify the marriage. Now, the argument on the other way, from Rabbi Broid and from the tripartite agreement, is, well, that's why we have all these special clauses in which he repeats the condition, and he says, I'm never going to cancel the condition, and he swears an oath that he's never going to cancel the condition. Although, I brought you on the sheet in sources number 17 and 18, that there are those who argue that even if you swear an oath that it's not going to be cancelled, nonetheless, if you cancel it, it's cancelled. Well, no, it's a shavuah, and then he broke it. But that's your psychological objection, the mind reading objection to the conditional marriage. And then in terms of the prearranged get, the argument is, of course the husband revokes the prearranged get. Don't bring me proofs from the case of the IDF. First of all, in the case of the IDF, the guy comes home for a couple of days. He's not living with her for years and years and years. That's argument number one. Number two, in the case that we're worried about, you're making this prenuptial agreement, and eventually the marriage indeed does break down. And at some point, the guy in this relationship is going to stand up and shout, I am not giving a get. Do you think that he is still living with his wife under the terms of this, I licensed somebody to give a get? At this point, he will say just the opposite. I am living with her, l'shem kiddushin. And unless she is sitting there every time saying, this is not l'shem kiddushin, this is not for the sake of kiddushin, you're going to have a very significant problem. Third, in the IDF case, he means the whole clause, licensing somebody to give the get out of love for her. Right? That's the whole point. That's why he does it. He does it in order to protect her. And therefore, he fully intends to follow through on this agreement. If he ever disappears, he wants somebody to write a get. Whereas in our case, the young couple who's getting married don't ever want to get divorced. They don't ever dream that this could happen. Therefore, he's entering into this with an assumption that this is never really going to come true. It's the opposite of the IDF case. In the IDF case, he says, you bet, I want this to be used if, God forbid, it's ever necessary. In the divorce case, that's his worst nightmare. He never wants this thing to actually happen. Further, we get again the argument of Be'ilas Zinus, the argument that, and I brought you the sources in the Shulchan Aruch in 19 to support it, the argument that that he doesn't want to license somebody to give the get, because indeed he wants to not have his relationship rendered Zinut. Rabbi Broid argues that's okay. Why? Because if he cancels the license to somebody to give the get, number one, he's violating a condition of the marriage. Right? Go back to the condition of the marriage. To which Rabbi Reis says, yeah, but we don't accept kiddushin conditions for nisuin. We don't accept conditions for marriage. And Rabbi Broid says, well, if he intended from the start to cancel this assignment, then it's kiddushei taos. Then he entered into it under false pretenses. That's his argument as well. To which the answer is, well, maybe he doesn't intend it originally, but it comes to him later on. This is the back and forth. I'm skipping elements of their back and forth because this is a 1 hour shiur, which is at 1 hour and 4 minutes. But the back and forth is not only about technical objections. Do you have precedent to do this or not? Do you have the right to create a shaliach before they've actually gotten married? Can you? Is there such a thing as a communal enactment to nullify things? But it's also psychological. It's the question of whether there's real intent here to go through with this, or whether just the opposite, the feeling is we never want to have to go through with this. Is there an argument that he doesn't want the relationships to be termed znut, and therefore he cancels the condition, he cancels the prearranged get? The psychological elements that are involved are very robust and are of great concern. So what you end up with is, I'm just going to take a minute just to summarize what we've done, and then I'll take questions, and those who have to leave are able to leave, and so on. But what you end up with here is the fundamental challenge of creating a legal fiction. When law says that something works, let's pretend we didn't have our technical challenges, right? We just had our psychological ones. When law says that something works, but psychology cries out that it's a legal fiction, do we have a right to proceed with it? Here, at the time of the marriage, he is, so to speak, a good guy. He wants to be married to his wife, they're in love with each other, everything's going to be wonderful. We're creating a document that's meant to be enforced only in the event that he becomes, so to speak, a bad guy. Right? That he is now refusing to cooperate with it. But at that point, he doesn't want it. It's operating against him. I'll give you the precedent. Think of the sale of chametz. Right? Mechiras chametz. Why do we sell our chametz? Why do we sell our chametz? No, we sell our chametz so that we can keep it. Right? That's what we do. We sell our chametz so that we will be able, after Pesach, to enjoy our Cheerios. Right? Or those who don't sell real chametz, that will be able to enjoy whatever other stuff we're selling. Fine. We sell the chametz in order to be able to keep it. It is a legal fiction in the sense that you are doing something which is 100% within the bounds of the law. The documents are written beautifully. All the kinyanim are great. But you really want to have your chametz in the end. But you get away with it when it comes to mechiras chametz. Why? First of all, because you're dealing with a derabanan. Right? Because you do your bittul anyway. I mean, there is a bittul ba'al masagi. When you're dealing with chametz, you don't own it on a biblical level anyway. It's just that we have a rabbinic obligation of, let's make sure we don't have it, and therefore we're going to engage in the sale. Are you willing to do that with a shesish? Are you willing to play that same game when what you're dealing with potentially is telling her she can go get married to somebody else and generating mamzerim? So Rabbi Reis's response is, I respect what you want to do, and we have the same goal, but we have a prenuptial agreement. And the prenuptial agreement that we have doesn't rely on the legal fiction. And so he says, let's go with that. To which the response from the supporters of the tripartite agreement is, your prenup doesn't work in every case. And it's true. Aside from the Canada problem, it still requires that the man cooperate. Let's say he has no funds whatsoever to use in order to pay this financial incentive that he's supposed to pay. There's nothing you can garnish, there's nothing that you can take from him. So now what are you going to do? He'll go, let him, whatever you're going to do to him, you fundamentally need his cooperation. So they're looking at this as a way to subvert the need for his cooperation. Everyone is dealing with what is fundamentally a very painful and difficult problem and trying to come up with ways to thwart it. And this way, as you see, some of the pieces of this have come around multiple times in recent halachic history. God willing, we should see the day, and not like years from now, but now, when aguna cases are done, when nobody is stuck in a relationship that they are not able to leave. Thank you very much. And again, I'm going to stick around now. We can have questions and discussion, but I want those who want to leave to be able to do so.